Chapter 34. Eric Stone's stomach was too knotted to eat the traditional astronaut's breakfast of steak and eggs. He wasn't nervous about the upcoming suborbital flight. In fact, he was eager for the experience. It was the fear of failure that cramped his body and turned his mouth as dry as the desert outside the hangar. He was all too aware that this was the single most important mission of his career, and no matter what happened in the future, nothing would top it. He was facing a life-defining moment with the fate of humanity resting in his hands. And if that weren't enough, he also couldn't get out of his mind the fact that Max Hanley was trapped on Eos Island. Like Mark Murphy, Eric had been catapulted by his intelligence to early success without giving him the time to properly mature. Mark hid it by playing at being a rebel, growing his hair long, blaring loud music, and pretending to flout authority. Eric had no such persona. He remained shy and socially awkward, so it was little wonder that he had always needed mentoring. In high school, the mentor had been a physics teacher. At Annapolis, an English instructor, who, ironically, he'd never had a class with. After he was commissioned, he couldn't find someone to take him under his wing. The military wasn't structured that way, and he was ready to leave after putting in his mandatory 5 years. Eric hadn't known it, but his last commanding officer had gotten word to an old friend, Hanley, that Stone would make an excellent addition to the corporation. When Max made the initial approach, Eric agreed to join almost immediately. He recognized in the former Swift Boat commander the same things he had seen in his old teachers. Max had this calm, steady demeanor and endless patience, and he knew how to nurture talent. He was slowly molding Eric into the man he always wanted to be. This was the other reason Eric couldn't eat and had slept only fitfully the night before. Success today would mean he had killed the man who had been more of a father to him than the man who had raised him. "You okay, son?" Jack Taggart asked as they were putting on their flight suits in a locker room behind the hangar office. The space plane's cabin was pressurized, so the suits were little more than olive drab overalls. "You look a little green around the gills."
"A lot on my mind, Colonel," Eric replied.
"Well, I don't want you to worry none about the flight," the former shuttle pilot drawled. "I'll get us there and back, no problem."
"I can honestly say that the last thing I'm concerned with is the flight itself."
A technician stuck his head into the room. "Gentlemen, you'd better shake a leg. Flight director wants Kanga rolling in 20 minutes.
Taggart snatched up his helmet from his locker and said, "Then let's go light this candle."
There were two reclined seats behind the pilot's position in the sleek space plane roo. Eric had spent the early morning hours securing his computer and the transmitter into one of them. He eased himself into the second and kept his hands away from his chest as workers belted him in as secure as a Grand Prix driver. Above him was a pair of windows, through which he could see the underside of the mothership. There were small windows on either side as well. Taggart was in front of him, talking to Flight Director Rick Butterfield. Eric jacked his helmet into a communications port and waited for a pause in Taggart's conversation to do a radio check on the flight frequency before switching over to another frequency, though he could still hear the pilot in one ear.
"Elton, this is John. How do you read me? Over."
Hali Kasim had picked the code names from the Elton John song, Rocket Man.
"John, this is Elton. Reading you 5x5. Over."
"Elton, prepare to receive telemetry on my mark."
3, 2, 1, mark."
Eric hit a key on his laptop so that Holly could monitor the flight and the Russian satellite in real time aboard the Oregon. He'd even rigged a webcam so his shipmates could see what he was seeing.
"John, signal looks good. Over."
"Okay, we're about 10 minutes from rollout.
I'll keep you updated. Over."
"Roger that. Good luck. Over."
The big hangar doors rattled open, bathing the cavernous space in the ruddy light of a new day. There were enough workers on hand to push Kanga out onto the apron. On the edge of the runway sat a ramshackle mobile home that was the flight director's control center. Its roof bristled with antennae and a pair of revolving radar dishes.
"How you doing back there?" Taggart called over his shoulder.
Before Eric could reply, the two turbojets mounted on the top of Kanga's fuselage roared into life. Taggart repeated the question over the radio because it was too loud to speak comfortably.
"Getting a little excited," Eric confessed.
"Don't forget, I'll flash a red light on your console when we're 10 seconds from the end of the burn. It'll turn yellow when we're at 5 and green when the rocket motor cuts out. At that moment, we'll be at an altitude of roughly 75 miles, but once the motor runs dry, we start falling immediately. So do your thing fast."
"You got it."
"Here we go," Taggart announced as Kanga started to taxi. The gawky mothership, with its droopy wings, rolled onto the runway and turned sharply to align with the center stripe. It began to accelerate immediately, the engines keening at full power. Designed for the sole purpose of getting Rue up to its launch altitude of 38,000 feet, Kanga wasn't the most dynamic aircraft in terms of performance. It used up nearly the entire runway before transitioning into the air to start its long, stately ascent. Out the side window, Eric could see its bizarre shadow racing across the scrub desert. It looked like something out of a science fiction movie. It took an hour for the plane to spiral up to altitude. Eric spent the time double-checking his equipment. Taggart merely sat quietly in his seat, playing a Game Boy flight simulator. They were 10 minutes early, according to Eric's timetable, so the plane carved lazy figure eights in the sky. High above them, the Soviet satellite was fast approaching. Unlike the shuttle or the International Space Station that orbited parallel to the equator, the orbital ballistic projectile weapon swept over the globe from pole to pole. In this way, it crisscrossed every square inch of the planet in 14 days, as the Earth revolved beneath it. It was currently over Wyoming, coming on at almost 5 miles per second. In its present orbital track, it wouldn't arrive over Eos Island for another week, which was why one of the signals Eric had to send was to fire its maneuvering rockets and change its vector. If everything went as planned, the satellite would be in range to fire one of its rods in less than 8 hours. "Coming up on T-minus 1 minute," Eric heard Butterfield announce. "All boards are green."
"Roger that, ground. 60 seconds.
A timer on Eric's console began to click backward, while the digital speed indicator mounted on the dashboard remained pegged at 400 miles per hour.
30 seconds. 10, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Go for separation.
The pilot aboard the mothership released a lever that held Rue clamped to the aircraft's belly. The space plane fell free for a few moments to get distance from Kanga before Taggart toggled the liquid rocket motor. To Eric, it felt as if every one of his senses was assaulted at the same instant. The roar of the engine was like standing at the base of a waterfall, a palpable sensation that beat on his chest. The airframe's vibrations forced him to clutch the armrest while he was slammed back into his seat, as if by a giant fist. His body shook inside his skin so much it felt like someone was rubbing him with sandpaper. His mouth had gone dry from the dose of adrenaline sent shooting into his veins. Focusing hard on the speedometer, he saw that in seconds they were nearing the sound barrier. The G-forces kept him pressed into his reclined seat as Taggart pointed the nose ever higher, the vibrations getting progressively worse, and Eric feared the airframe would come apart in midair. And then they burst through the sound barrier. The vibrations diminished, and while he could still feel the thrust of the engine, they were traveling faster than its throaty snarl, and it grew noticeably quieter. 1 minute after the motor kicked in, they burst above 100,000 feet, and Eric was finally coming to grips with the ride. His heart rate slowed, and for the moment, he let himself enjoy the space plane's raw power. The airspeed gauge hit 2,000 miles per hour, and they still accelerated. Looking over his head, he noticed the sky darkening rapidly as they roared up through the atmosphere. As if by magic, stars began to appear, faintly at first, but brightening. He had never seen so many so clearly. Gone was the twinkle caused by their light passing through Earth's atmosphere. They held steady, and their numbers swelled until it looked as though space was made of light rather than darkness. He knew if he stretched out his hand, he would be able to touch them. The indicator in front of him suddenly flashed red. He couldn't believe 4 minutes could pass that quickly. Straining against the G's, he moved his hand over to the laptop. 10 seconds, he said on the frequency the Oregon was monitoring. If Holly replied, it was lost in the rocket's din. The altimeter was still reeling off numbers in a blur. They hit 394,000 feet when the light went yellow, and in those last 5 seconds, they rose another mile. The indicator turned green just as they hit the 400,000-foot mark. Eric typed in the command as the rocket motor consumed the last of its fuel and the cyclonic pumps that fed it went quiet. The G-forces that had hammered him into his seat suddenly released him, and the silence left his ears ringing. They had gone weightless. He had often experienced moments of it on roller coasters and on a few flights with Tiny Gunderson when they were fooling around, but this felt different. They were on the very edge of space now, not playing tricks with gravity, but almost out of its reach. In the cockpit, Jack Taggart activated the armatures that raised the entire wing so it was at an angle to the fuselage. The added drag and the dynamics of the new configuration kept the plane incredibly stable as it started its long glide back to the airfield outside of Monahans, Texas.
"What did you think?" he asked.
"Just a moment."
Taggart thought Eric might be sick, and he craned around to look, but Stone was concentrating on his computer. The kid had just been given the ride of his life, and he was already working. Taggart admired the dedication, thinking back to his first shuttle mission. He hadn't been able to do anything but stare out the window his first hour up here.
"Repeat that, Elton. Over."
"I said, we've got confirmation from the bird's onboard telemetry. She has fired her maneuvering thrusters and is changing orbit. Targeting computers are online, and it's going through its pre-fire checklist.
Congratulations. You did it."
Eric didn't know if he wanted to shout for joy or cry. In the end, he settled for simple satisfaction that his plan was going to work. He had to give credit to the Russians. When it came to their space program, they knew what they were doing. Where NASA was all about elegant finesse, the Soviets had gone for simplicity and brute force, and as a result, they built to last. Their Mir space station remained in orbit twice as long as originally planned. Had it not been for lack of funds, it would likely still be up there.
"Roger that. Over and out."
"Well?" Taggart asked.
"It worked. We now have control of the Russian satellite."
"I wasn't asking about that. I want to know what you thought of the flight."
"Colonel? That was the most amazing thing I have ever experienced," Eric said, feeling weight slowly returning to his body. His stomach settled back into its normal position.
"I know it won't go into the books, but just so you know, we broke the altitude record. We're going to limit our paying flights to about 330,000 feet, so it's a record that'll be around for a while."
Eric chuckled to himself, thinking how jealous Murph was going to be, and how impressed Yanni would be. But no sooner had the thought crossed his mind, the smile died on his lips, and he once again considered Max Hanley's fate.